Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane. A week ago today, flash floods compounded the devastation in the aftermath of the wildfires near Twisp, Washington.
The culvert's plugged and the water's undercutting the road. You see that little cottonwood there? That's where the edge of the road used to be.
We'll hear from some residents of Finley Canyon, where people lost vehicles, livestock, and homes. Also in the half hour, PAC money in the fight to control the Washington State Senate, and how one woman is using a new Washington law to help her in her search for her birth parents. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. In Washington, Democrats are desperate to win back control of the state Senate. A mostly Republican coalition is determined to hold on to the majority. The November election will decide who comes out on top. In the meantime, big money interests on both sides are trying to influence that outcome. They're pouring unlimited contributions into soft money accounts controlled by the legislative caucuses. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins explains.
State Senator Tim Sheldon climbs into his pickup truck and takes me on a jouncing tour of his family's 500-acre tree farm on a hillside overlooking Hood Canal.
These are some of the logs that we'll take out. They're real tight grain Douglas fir that will make really nice lumber.
Up here, Sheldon is king of the hill, but when he leaves his gated property, he has a political target on his back. Last year, Sheldon, always a maverick Democrat, joined with Republicans to help them take control of the Washington Senate. Now Democrats are determined to take him out this November.
They lost the majority. They want it back.
And now they've shown just how serious they are. After the August primary, the Senate Democrats' Political Action Committee, called the Kennedy Fund, transferred $250,000 into another PAC. This one set up for the exclusive purpose of defeating Tim Sheldon and electing his challenger, another Democrat named Irene Bolling.
$250,000 is a lot of money.
They're gunning for you.
Sure.
Now, Sheldon's not outgunned. Business interests spent heavily on his behalf in the primary. For her part, Irene Bolling says she had no idea Senate Democrats were about to dump that kind of money into the 35th Legislative District.
We found out about it through the newspaper, basically.
Good thing she didn't know. State law prohibits these independent expenditure campaigns from coordinating with candidates. But now that she does know, Bolling's pleased.
Because it shows that there's real faith that we can beat Tim Sheldon.
It also shows something else. Over the past 20 years, Washington's legislative caucuses have become sophisticated political operators. Today, all four of the caucuses, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, operate their own political action committees. State law restricts how PACs can spend money, but they can take in unlimited contributions.
These political action committees are essentially tactical weapons.
That's Paul Barrett. He's a former Washington Democratic Party chairman. Barrett says these legislative soft money PACs have evolved as a legal way to work around Washington's strict campaign contribution limits.
This is what's allowed under the law, and as long as it is, this is what you're going to see these campaign organizations do.
So let's trace where that $250,000 to defeat Tim Sheldon and elect Irene Bolling came from. The single biggest contributor to the Senate Democrats' Kennedy Fund is the Service Employees International Union. SEIU and its locals dumped $200,000 into the Kennedy Fund in June and July. SEIU would not comment for this story. Other large contributors include the Community Health Network of Washington, the state's Teachers Union, and Washington Tribes. State Senator Sharon Nelson leads the Democratic caucus. I met her outside a waterfront restaurant in Tacoma.
Am I catching you after a fundraising lunch?
No comment.
In her role as Democratic leader, Nelson helps raise money for the Kennedy Fund. I asked her what the top donors to this PAC are buying with their big checks.
I would not use the term buying. I think what they're saying is they support the kind of policies the Democrats promote.
But is it not too much influence? Do you not then owe them something in return because they could write you that big check?
I don't think so. I think everybody knows who the usual stakeholders are for the Republicans versus the Democrats.
Basically, it boils down to business versus labor. Washington Senate Republicans PAC is called the Leadership Council. It got $50,000 from the Farmers Insurance Employees and Agents PAC in July. That same month, the Washington Restaurant Association hand-delivered a $40,000 check.
It is an unusual contribution from us, and it's a significant contribution for us.
Bruce Beckett is the Restaurant Association's head of government affairs. He says his group ponied up big this year because control of the Washington Senate is on the line. The check was handed over at a private dinner with Senate Republican leader Mark Schessler.
Well, obviously, because it was a fairly substantial amount.
Do you put the check in an envelope? Or?
Yes, they're in an envelope.
And you hope the guy doesn't get mugged on the way out the door.
Well, that's not our problem at that point.
Nor is how the Leadership Council spends the Restaurant Association's money. By law, PAC donors can't earmark their contributions. But Beckett acknowledges the money could get spent on what PACs have become famous for, negative ads.
And that always makes us a little bit nervous because then, in some respects, those who are funding it get blamed for that. But, you know, I guess that's a risk that comes along with being part of the process.
Senate Republicans declined to comment on tape for this story. Democrats and Republicans in the Washington House also have their own soft money accounts, the Truman and Reagan funds. So far combined, all four PACs have taken in more than $4 million this year, with the Senate Republican Leadership Council getting the most. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
People near the town of Twisp, Washington, are digging out from under mud that ripped through canyons in north-central Washington state last week. The massive Carlton Complex fires have singed the ground there. That leaves soil and rock primed to run downhill. So more damage could be on the way. Correspondent Anna King was in Twisp Thursday night as the storm triggered flash floods, and she has this story.
It was about 6 on Thursday night when strong winds kicked sand into my eyes. Then just moments later, the rain and thunder started to pound. Few people were prepared for how bad the rain would get that night and what it would do to nearby Findlay Canyon. Within an hour, emergency vehicles were streaming out of Twisp. A sheriff's deputy started turning cars around.
Yeah, the water's crossed the roadway north of there, and it's a washout south of there. So hang out in Twist for a while.
Some people battled past the gunk up canyon, right as water, mud, and rock was flowing down. Maggie Garrett and a neighbor jumped into a truck and headed up to save her 8 Arabian and Appaloosa horses. She says they were trapped in their pens, with mud up to their bellies.
The water came down so fast and so strong. It was literally 4 to 5 feet deep. All I could do, my horses are right in the middle of it, and all I could do was stand on the road and watch my horses fight to stay above water and to watch some of them almost give up. And I know that they wouldn't have made it if I wasn't there calling their names and asking them to get to their feet. And they would. They'd fight and fight and climb back up and scream. Not just a regular whinny, but I mean just scream.
Garrett says she watched helpless for what seemed like a long while.
Watching chunks of buildings go by, chickens floating down the river. You know, I'm saying river because that's exactly what it was like. My stack of hay, you know, I don't know, 12, 15 ton, just blew apart like it was paper.
The torrent slowed enough that night she could wade through to free her animals. Days later, she still hasn't had time to wash the hip-high mudded jeans she wore. 3 small lakes of water penned up behind private and public dams came down this valley that night. But state ecology department experts say even more damage came from the 1.5 inches of rain. It funneled down the barren hillsides into the canyon bottom. Nothing held it back. The morning after, the destruction snapped into focus. Chipmunks and people alike were upset. Helicopters were up. A large river slicked over a smooth stretch of highway then formed a 20-foot-tall waterfall. I saw a car-sized chunk of pavement fall in. Cattle were washed away, homes inundated. Residents used small tractors, chainsaws, shovels, anything they had to save their remaining property. Rory Williams is a 30-year-old dad of two. He snuffles softly to his family's pigs to greet them. He says at least these pigs, their family home and lane chickens, escaped the muck.
The devastation this morning is just overwhelming with having to deal with the fires that just came through here, you know, a month ago. And it's just, we're ready for it to be done.
His family's driveway and alfalfa field are obliterated.
You know, we lost all our gardens last night. All the food that we put away for wintertime is gone. Luckily, our pigs and our chickens made it, but I'm sure there's some stuff that we haven't realized is gone.
Looking around his farm, Williams sees nothing ahead but work and more work. Irrigation lines are tacoed, fencing's busted, and he fears more rain and mud could come. Washington State officials and private engineers are working on the two remaining dams that hold up much larger lakes right above this valley. Residents have been warned. Without these lakes, it's unclear if irrigation to Findlay Canyon will be restored. Most people here are depending on help from friends and family. People here look very tired. One Findlay Canyon resident with a wry mouth says, "What's next? Frogs falling from the sky?" I'm Anna King in Findlay Canyon, outside of Twisp.
A new Washington law that went into effect this summer offers new hope for adoptees searching for their birth records. Lynn Hogan is one of hundreds of adoptees who have petitioned the state under the new law, seeking information about their birth parents and hoping it will lead to a chance to meet them. But as Ruby DeLuna explains, the law offers no guarantees.
Okay, so this is like the Luke, I am your father moment.
Lynn Hogan filed her request for her birth records before July. A couple of weeks later, an envelope from the Department of Health came in the mail. She's about to open it.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe how like crazy this is. Wow, so this is my original birth certificate. Here's her last name. Wow. But it doesn't say the father. That's just amazing. Let's see. And then, oh, I should have worn my glasses. So she's 20 when she had me, and she was born in Minnesota.
Hogan was thrilled to finally have a copy of her birth certificate. She searched through the letter from the department to see if her birth mother is open to a meeting.
From this, I can't really tell if she was contacted or not, because it doesn't really tell me.
It's not clear whether Hogan has permission to get in touch with her birth mother. I put that question to State Registrar Christy Spice. Her office is responsible for collecting and maintaining vital records, including birth certificates. The state tried to get the word out about the new law to give birth parents the option to maintain their privacy. But, Spice explains, there was no way for her office to individually contact all birth parents, especially with adoptions that took place decades ago. She says since July of last year, birth parents have been able to file a contact preference form. It lets the office know whether to release birth certificates and whether they're open to meeting their children. And if an adoptee receives a copy of the birth record,
what it really means is we didn't hear anything from the birth parent one way or the other. So the law says in that situation, the default position is we release the record. And then again, I think it's up to the adoptee to choose at this point whether or not to seek out contact with the birth parent.
Spice says to date, her office has received more than 1,400 requests from adoptees. Only 212 birth parents have filed forms. Most have requested to keep their records sealed. Lynn Hogan says she was hoping for more information, like knowing for sure that her birth mother would be open to meeting.
I really feel like I want to move forward. I would really like to contact her. I have no plan, but except I know I'm going to contact her, and it's probably going to be a letter. I think a a phone call is too jarring.
Hogan says at least she has more information to work with. She has her birth mother's full name and last known address. I'm Ruby DeLuna, reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, Lynn Diddanayan spent over a decade compiling and corroborating details of a Native American woman who, as an independent businesswoman, owned property and tidelands in her own name in the late 1800s.
There are so many stories not told. There's so many histories and people left out of our histories. That's what my work has to be now. I feel that it's my obligation to do that.
Diddanayan eventually published a book telling the story of oyster woman Katie Gale. Now she encourages others to tell little-known stories. Tom Bonsi reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Cloudy after morning fog and drizzle in some areas. Highs today 65 to 70 with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tonight mostly cloudy, overnight lows in the low 50s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says a low-pressure trough will allow a weak front to move across later tomorrow into early Saturday morning, giving us an increased chance of showers. Labor Day is still looking partly sunny, with the high then close to 70. It started with the discovery of long-forgotten gravestones in a thicket of bramble and alder. That led one author on a faint trail of a feisty Native American woman and oyster farmer who lived in 19th century Western Washington. The biographer is using the resulting book to inspire other Northwesterners, particularly tribal members. She wants to bring out the stories of people who, in her words, have been left out of our histories. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Oyster Bay in Mason County, Washington.
The waterfront cottage Lynn Diddanayan calls home overlooks a cultural crossroads rich in history. So it's fortunate she's a cultural anthropologist by profession. Her eyes and ears are tuned to signs and stories of place. And at this place, waves of settlers came from the earliest times to reap shellfish.
This crunch, crunch underneath here. Yes. We're on a white beach in some respects, but it's not white sand like in Hawaii. These are all oyster shells.
These are Pacific oyster shells, and These are left from the time when the Brenner Oyster Company was a going thing. And so we have...
It's quite the going thing.
Diddanayan moved here in the early 1970s. In recent decades, she heard enough tales about one pioneer to start a file. The name was Katie Gale. This independent businesswoman owned property and tidelands in her own name in the late 1800s.
And that was all a little bit unusual from sort of conventional wisdom or things that I'd heard about both people in the oyster business and Native American women.
The biographer was fascinated by how Gale straddled different worlds and stood up for herself and her mixed-race children.
I suppose there were just too many things about that that intrigued me that I couldn't let go of it. And I literally couldn't let go of it for years.
A turning point came when Diddanayan and several friends from the Historical Society discovered an overgrown little homestead graveyard a mile from her house. One of the headstones belonged to Katie Gale.
I was so amazed, excited, enthralled that I began beating on Stan's shoulders as he was kneeling in front of me holding the stone.
Her friend had to plead with her to contain her excitement and stop it.
I literally said, "I know who this is," as if she were an acquaintance of mine, but it almost felt that way. And that became, I would say, that was a moment of calling. I have to tell this woman's story. I have to know her.
But here's the problem. The long-dead Katie Gale left no letters, no journals. Diddanayan could find no photographs of her, no living descendants. The best source material was a divorce case file. It took almost a decade to accumulate corroborating details, context, and enough educated guesses to write a biography. Katie Gale, A Coast Salish Woman's Life on Oyster Bay, was published last fall. But the tale doesn't stop there.
There are so many stories not told. There's so many histories and people left out of our histories. That's what my work has to be now. I feel that it's my obligation to do that.
Yeah, okay. So,
which brings us to a writing class at the Evergreen State College Longhouse in Olympia. Dedenan is a guest speaker.
So good morning, everybody. The first thing I'd like
Dedenan to do... Dedenan exhorts the seminar to bring forth stories before they're lost, perhaps starting with family history. This is a message Dedenan returns to again and again in regular public talks and one-on-one mentoring.
You're able to find out a lot, more than you think.
All of the students in the circle facing the author this day are Native American. It takes a while, but eventually sensitivities come out.
I was really hesitant about taking the class.
This student's grandmothers warned her against exposing too much of their Spokane tribal heritage to outsiders who might twist it or exploit it. Macaw tribal member Vince Cook heard that from his elders, too.
That's a tough one, because when I was younger, we were told not to record, not to videotape.
Cook says attitudes are changing now. As people see tradition and culture slipping away, he feels spurred to write about his great-grandmother and all the things she taught him.
I think it's important to continue on, not only for myself, but for my family and for others to know about the Macaw culture and to keep it alive.
Another person who says author Dedenan encouraged him is amateur folklorist Cy Matta of rural PL, Washington. Matta's focus is on gathering the stories of his ancestors from the Cascade Indian tribe who once lived and fished in the Columbia River Gorge. He's approaching the task in a thoroughly modern way by soliciting and sharing material and old photographs via a website and Facebook page. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Finally, we'll hear about an enterprising woman who operates an entire restaurant all by herself, cooking, serving, and cleaning. Her four-table restaurant in a Portland suburb is a success. Reporter Alex Johnson takes us to Gloria's Secret Cafe to see how she does it all.
Here's how it works. Gloria's Secret Cafe is only open for breakfast and lunch. But if you call Gloria a few weeks in advance and tell her you'd like to have dinner, she'll open up the restaurant just for you and your friends. It's like a private dinner party, but in a nice restaurant where you don't have to cook or clean up, and the host is immediately your best friend. I first had dinner at Gloria's a little over a year ago. Then, a few months later, I barged in on someone else's dinner with a microphone. I started off in Gloria's tiny kitchen, where she was preparing an appetizer.
This is my guacamole, and then right now they're going to get a Salvadorian guacamole, which is this one. And this one has queso and boiled eggs. I know it sounds weird, but that's what we do, and it's just different. Gloria's Secret has got a little bit of everything. A little bit of Spain, a little bit of Mexico. You know, a lot from El Salvador, actually, because I got the chuletas, the pupusas, the tamales, you know, so a little bit more, yeah.
The dining area is just a few paces away from the kitchen. There were about 10 people huddled around two of Gloria's tables. Travis Tacano had just had some particularly spicy ceviche.
I love cilantro, so I got the one with the habanero, which I just found out.
You're drawing me a river.
I don't know if you can see this, but I am just dripping with sweat right here.
That was Gloria in the background giving Travis a hard time. And that's the beauty of the whole thing. You show up at this restaurant that looks like any other restaurant. But while you're there, the owner is telling you stories. She's telling you about what you just ate and what you'll be eating next. Sometimes she's standing at the table, and sometimes she's hollering at you from the kitchen. For every minute of it, you feel like you're part of her family. Rosa Faust is from Lake Oswego, Oregon. She's the one who called Gloria and set up the dinner for tonight.
She is so humble about her food. She is just, I mean, she's a one-woman show. She does everything. She cooks. She does the serving. She does all the cleaning. I've had almost everything on her menu, and there's no bad dish.
Of course, running an entire restaurant without help isn't always fun and easy. Most of the time, Gloria puts a positive spin on it. But doing what she does is really difficult. She opened up to me about that when the restaurant wasn't so busy.
You know, I'm just crazy. That's the only reason why I do this, is I'm just crazy. You'd have to be crazy to do what I do. I think about it, I go, oh my God, what am I doing? you know. This is so much. All the work. So, I mean, all the work that you do, you know, and you really, you're not getting rich. You're just actually, you're just doing it, really, you know. And I'm not getting, you know, I'm not getting rich. I'm making a living. That's about it.
Gloria is doing this all by herself, but sometimes she wishes she didn't have to be so DIY. I asked her what she would do if she had more money, more space, and a little more help.
You know, my problem is that I do everything. So I have a four-table restaurant that I wasn't planning on having. So, but I need to expand. I really do. In order to be able to hire, you know, I would employ tons of people. But people myself here, it's and then the money that it's going to take to do something else, to get into a bigger place, it's where I'm having a problem.
Occasionally she'll bring in a friend or relative to help. But there's only so much you can do with four tables and a location that doesn't get a lot of foot traffic.
I work 14 hours sometimes a day. So, meaningly, if I went and got a job for 8 hours a day, that would still be a vacation for me. And I wouldn't have to work so much like I do here and really not make the money.
It's clearly work that she loves doing. Gloria's devotion to the Secret Cafe serves to remind her customers that sharing food is an intimate way to connect. It brings us closer to the people we're with. And, if we're lucky, the person who prepared our food. I'm Alex Johnson.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to News1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today. Listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.